So, hello and welcome back to another PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Joe Keating.
How are you doing, Joe?
I'm doing excellent, thank you.
What have you been up to today?
Well, at the moment I'm in the middle of a big literature review of growing heterostricans, which has been quite interesting. I'm starting to get in my teeth into it now. It's taken a while.
And so what are you looking at? Like, is that how they grow from a juvenile into an adult and the patterns you can see in that?
Pretty much. The patterns you see on the surface are different from the patterns that you see when you look internally. So I've been wading through the literature way back to 1835. The first mention of this is a Swiss paleontologist called Louis Agassiz. But then there's a lot of references that are in German and French, and I don't speak either of those languages. So good old Google Translate's been helping me out.
Yeah, we need to get some of our German listeners to help you out there. We've actually got quite a few. I've been looking at the statistics and been following that quite closely. Separated by 10 downloads, we've got a battle for first place between Victoria, Australia, Ontario, Canada, California in the US, and London in the UK.
So recommend us to your friends.
So long as they live near you.
So long as they live near you.
Go knock on next door and tell them to download.
It's worth pointing out that the introductions to these paleocasts have been described by my supervisor as shambolic.
Well, hopefully today our interview will be less shambolic. So we're talking to Dr. Robert Nell from Queen Mary University London on sexual selection.
And sexual selection is something that we've been meaning to do for a long time. So we touched upon it with the Dave Hone episode of looking at archosaurs through the Mesozoic. But this time we're really going to get our teeth into sexual selection, find out what it's about, and can we see it in the fossil record?
So joining us today is Rob Nell from Queen Mary University of London. Could you give us an introduction about yourself, Rob, and your research interests?
Okay, hello guys. Well, I'm actually a biologist, not a paleontologist, and I've done a lot of work on sexual selection, which is what we're going to be talking about today. And some of the things that I work on are beetles, which have sexually selected horns, which they fight with. And the reason I got into looking at sexual selection in fossils is that I was reading Richard Forty's book on trilobites, and it had some photos in of fossil trilobites with things growing out of their anterior end. And there was a section in the book saying these trilobites have got these funny things growing out of the anterior end of the fossil, and we don't know what they are. And I looked at them and I sent Richard a photo of beetle horns and said, look, they're the same. And so we wrote a paper that basically said, look, beetle horns and these anterior spines on these trilobites, they're the same. Maybe they were the same. And that's how I got into looking at sexual selection in paleontological material as well as in live animals.
I think it might be worthwhile pointing out that the PaleoCast logo is one of these trilobites.
It's indeed a
Willisirops, and it's got this strange trident on its head.
That's right. And the one on your logo is probably a female.
All right, okay. So how do you tell the difference between females and males? And
well,
this
we
instance?
Can't. But
all right.
But looking at photos of Willisirops, there seems to be quite a clear differentiation between ones with little short tridents and ones with really long tridents. And whether that's two separate species or whether it's one species with differentiation between males and females, we don't know. But my guess is it's that one's male and one's female, although that is only a guess. And the one on your logo is a short trident one rather than the long trident one.
I think we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves, actually. So can we start off with sexual selection? What is it?
Sexual selection is one of the two main driving forces of evolution. And it was first identified by Darwin. So Darwin wrote The Origin of Species, where he talked about natural selection. And then a few years later, he wrote a book called The Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex, where he talked a lot about sexual selection. And sexual selection is the process of selection whereby an animal's fitness or a plant's fitness is increased when it acquires more mating opportunities or just produces more offspring. So when we think about natural selection, a lot of the time we're thinking about things like ability to avoid predators, ability to find food, ability to exist in a certain environment and to survive and thrive in a certain environment. Sexual selection is all about, can you get more matings than the other guy? It's usually a guy, sometimes a female.
So what kind of animals do we see sexual selection in today?
Lots and lots of them. It's almost ubiquitous throughout the animal kingdom. Sometimes the effects are quite subtle and sometimes they're extremely unsubtle. So examples of animals with extremely unsubtle sexually selected traits are things like peacocks and their close relatives and pheasants, which have got very large sexually selected tails. Birds of paradise, the amazing plumage of birds of paradise is sexually selected. Sexually selected traits can also be things that you can't see, but you can hear. So cricket song and a lot of bird song is sexually selected. And a lot of the weapons that we see in animals today are sexually selected. So deer antlers, beetle horns, which I've already mentioned, the large incisors in a lot of primates, those are weapons, but they're weapons that are used not usually to fight predators, but to fight other males of the same species in order to get access to females and increase the mating opportunities for the males.
So are all these structures modified, or are there actually new structures added onto the organism that have an only a sexual purpose?
Some of them are modified, but lots of them are actually new structures. So if you look at crickets, for example, they sing by rubbing their wings together, but they actually have specific structures. There's a harp and a file, they're called, on the wing, that have no purpose apart from making the cricket song. And lots of other things have traits that really have no purpose at all apart from playing a role in sexual selection. So things like peacock's tails, for example, they're not really much use in flight anymore. They're essentially purely playing a role in sexual selection.
So you say that they're not useful in flight. Does that give the peacock a disadvantage in that respect?
It certainly does. Peacocks can't fly very well. And I've been told by Marion Petrie, who is one of the big experts on peacock sexual selection, that in the wild in India, the tail of the peacock makes it very easy for tigers to catch them. Because what the tiger does is it just walks up behind the peacock and puts its paw on the tail. And then it's got a tasty peacock snack. And if you ever go to Africa, if you go to South Africa or East Africa, one of the sort of classic sexually selected organisms that people have worked on a lot is the widow bird, which, much like the peacock, has very long tail feathers, although it doesn't display them in a fan. And if you watch widow bird, male widow birds flying during the mating season when they've got their full breeding plumage, they can really hardly fly. So quite often sexually selected structures impose quite a considerable cost on the bearer. And this was why Darwin was interested in them. He saw them as being almost paradoxical in terms of natural selection. But then when he realized that the enhanced mating opportunities that they bring cancel out the effect of the sexually selected traits on what you might call natural selection, then he realized how these structures could evolve.
So it's just a straight trade-off. You make yourself more susceptible to being eaten or less able to function in your habitat, but you make it so that you're more attractive.
Exactly. And the increase in fitness you get from your increased reproductive output presumably at the very least cancels out the decrease in fitness from being hardly able to fly or being eaten by a tiger.
So this might seem like a hard question to answer, But why would a female of the species be preferentially attracted to a male that has this big disadvantage, like these giant feathers or other sexual structures that are going to make him more difficult to survive in the wild?
That is indeed a very hard question to answer. And there have been a lot of evolutionary biologists who've been working hard at answering that question for about the last 30 years. And in fact, that question's even harder to answer than you might think at first. So I'll explain why. There's two possible explanations as to why females might prefer males with large traits that don't otherwise serve a purpose. One explanation is what we call Fisherian runaway selection, and I'm not going to talk about that in much more detail. The other one is an idea that was first produced by an Israeli scientist called Arpad Zahavi, and he came up with something called the handicap principle. And what he proposed was that large sexually selected structures were signaling some kind of genetic quality of the bearer. So if the sexually selected structure is costly, then if an animal can grow that sexually selected structure, it's demonstrating that it's able to carry that cost. And the example that people always use is it's the same as males of Homo sapiens driving around in a Ferrari. They're demonstrating that they can pay the cost of having a Ferrari. And what Zahavi suggested was maybe females are choosing to mate with males with these large structures because what they're gaining from it is good quality genes to give to their offspring. And that seemed like a great explanation. But then pretty quickly people realized that there's a problem there, which is that if these males are advertising good quality genes, then pretty quickly, if the females are choosing to mate with them, those good quality genes should go to fixation in the population. So in other words, all the variation in quality in the males should be removed by the female choice faster than it can arise by mutation. So that put everyone back to trying to work out what was going on. And the answer that we've come up with now, that was originally thought of by a guy in Canada called Locke Rowe, is that it seems that these traits are signaling not just the quality of one or two genes, but the overall quality of the organism. They're what we call condition dependent. And their size is determined by the overall condition of the organism. And what Locke Rowe pointed out was that if it's the overall condition of the organism that's affecting the size of these traits, then that's a very large target for mutation, because essentially it's the whole genome that these traits are reflecting. And if that's the case, then the genome is sufficiently large that mutation can introduce variation into these genes for quality at the same speed that females can remove them. So it seems that the solution to what we call the Lek paradox, which is the paradox of why genetic variation still persists in these males, is that these sexually selected traits are reflecting not just one or two genes for quality, but the quality of the entire genome. And that seems to be, I'm going to stick my head above the parapet and say, I think this is the solution to the problem. And I think that females are selecting males because they're getting good quality genes for their offspring on that basis.
Is it always a case of the bigger or brighter the better, or are there more subtle features that could have evolved as the result of sexual selection?
Yeah, that is a good question. And the answer is, yeah, there are some quite subtle things that you won't see. So when we're thinking about sexual selection, a lot of the time we're looking at these very obvious, very large, very bright, very conspicuous traits. But sexual selection also acts at a number of other levels. So there's a phenomenon called sperm competition, which was first recognized by a guy in Liverpool called Jeff Parker, which is a component of sexual selection. And sperm competition is what happens after mating. If a female mates with more than one male, then essentially the sperm of those males is in competition to fertilize the eggs. And you end up with all kinds of very, very strange things evolving as a consequence of that. So to give you one example, testis size across pretty much anything you care to mention seems to be determined by how strong sperm competition is. So animals that are exposed to very high levels of sperm competition, such as male bonobos, have very large testes for their body size, and animals that are exposed to only a small or an intermediate amount of sperm competition, like Homo sapiens or gorillas, have quite small testes for their body size. So that's one subtle effect of sperm competition. Another subtle effect of sperm competition that's arising as a consequence of sexual selection is that you get interesting things injected into females by males to reduce the amount of sperm competition they experience. So male fruit flies, Drosophila, for example, have accessory gland proteins in their ejaculate that they inject into the female when they mate with her. And these accessory gland proteins reduce the probability of a female Drosophila remating. So they enhance that male's reproductive output because his sperm get a longer time to fertilize her eggs. But the really interesting thing about them is they also reduce the female's lifespan. So the male's essentially poisoning the female in order to enhance his own reproductive output. So that's another subtle effect of sexual selection and sperm competition. And the third really amazing example of sort of subtle effects of sperm competition comes from bedbugs and a number of other closely related species. When you have sperm competition, then the female is going to be selected to control which male's sperm actually fertilize her eggs. So if she's mated with two males and one of them she's able to perceive is a higher quality male than the other, she wants the higher quality male's sperm to fertilize her eggs. So females are in an arms race with males in order to control fertilization. And in the bedbugs, this has gone to a very extreme situation where the male bedbugs actually have bypassed the female's entire reproductive tract. And when a male bedbug mates with a female bedbug, he doesn't mate with her in the normal way. He's got a rather pointy intromittent organ, which he punches through her abdominal wall in order to inject the sperm straight into her hemolymph, which is the insect equivalent of blood, with the idea that the sperm should then make their own way to the eggs, bypassing the female's reproductive tract and removing control of fertilization from the female. And the really amazing, the even more amazing thing about these bedbugs is that the female bedbugs have now evolved a structure where the male bedbug usually stabs them in the abdomen, which receives that sperm and then gives control of fertilization back to the female, because the female is then able to decide whether or not to allow those sperm to fertilize her eggs. So those are all really quite, well, I suppose stabbing a female in the abdomen isn't very subtle, but these are not big or bright consequences of sexual selection, and ones that you have to look quite hard to actually see.
The darker side of sexual selection.
The darker side of sexual selection, indeed, yes.
Because normally it's the female that chooses the mate, and this is starting to swing the other way, where it looks as if, in the case with the Drosophila and the bedbugs, that it's the male trying to take control and choose the female. Or do they just do it indiscriminately to all of them?
The males will probably mate with lots and lots of females. Mm. But they're trying to control whether those females are able... They're trying to take control of fertilization from those females that they mate with.
So this kind of sexual arms race as such, does this only occur when there's no evolutionary arms race? So they don't have to compete against other animals. So to be the most successful, they're starting to compete against other specimens from the same species.
No. This happens in the context of the animals also in competition with other species. The animals also being in a particular environment and having to be adapted to that environment. There's some evidence that if you relax the environmental conditions, then you can get more sexual selection. So in birds, for example, there's a cline of sexual dimorphism where as you go towards the equator, birds tend to be more sexually dimorphic. And that's because there's more resources available towards the equator in general as a massive approximation. And that means that the closer you get to the equator, the more easy it is for a single female bird to raise a brood. And in that case, the male birds are then kind of freed from the responsibility of having to raise the offspring. And that then enables, that then leads to them being more sexually selected. So there is an interaction with the environment, but certainly a lot of this sexual selection happens in the context of, you know, strong competition with other species, adaptation to the environment, and the full whack of normal natural selection.
Can more than one character be selected for?
Yep, absolutely. There's lots of examples of species with multiple sexual ornaments. Back to the birds of paradise, you know, they don't just have one bit of plumage, they have lots of different bits of plumage that they wave at the female. And there's lots of other examples of animals with these multiple sexual ornaments. We're not quite sure what's going on with a lot of the multiple sexual ornaments. It's possible that separate sexual ornaments are actually signaling different aspects of male quality in some way, or it could be that they're all signaling the same thing and just giving a bigger signal to the female. There's quite a lot of ongoing research on that at the moment, and I don't have really a good feeling as to what the answer is.
So is it always one sex that displays sexual structures, or can both sexes of the species have sexual structures?
Yeah, both sexes can have sexual ornamentation. That's really quite a common phenomenon. So in addition to straight female choice, where you've got females choosing males, or straight intersexual competition amongst males, where the males beat each other up to get access to females, there's also what we call mutual choice, where essentially the males are choosing the females and the females are choosing the males. And that can lead to species where both sexes are ornamented. And what we find if we look at things like birds is that you get birds that have conspicuous ornaments but aren't sexually dimorphic. If you think of magpies, for example, and you can make a good argument that those birds are actually, that both sexes of those birds are actually sexually selected and that they're engaging in this mutual selection phenomenon.
Is that why both sexes of robins, for instance, have red breasts?
Could well be, yeah.
A lot of the characters that we've been talking about don't really serve any function other than to be sexually attractive. So is that the case for all of them, or can any of them be co-opted into performing alternative functions?
Yeah, they can often perform alternative functions. And we talked earlier about the enlarged canines of male primates. And obviously, while those are mostly used to threaten other male primates of the same species, they can also use them in combat with, say, predators or competitors from other species. And if you think about things like muskox, for example, that have got horns that they use in contests with each other, they also use those horns when they're facing predators. So a lot of animal weaponry serves a dual purpose. And then there are also other aspects of some sexually selected traits that seem to have other purposes as well. So some ungulate horns, for example, seem to have a thermoregulatory function. They're useful for the animal for losing heat in a hot environment.
Is there a case where sexual selection is thought to have resulted in new species or species differentiation?
Yep, absolutely. Cichlids in Lake Malawi are thought to speciate very, very rapidly, at least in part because of the way sexual selection operates. And what you'll find is that females will have a preference for a particular colour. And then if you get another colour arising essentially in the males, and some of the females prefer that colour, then that's going to lead to reproductive isolation of one component of the population. And that seems to be leading to very rapid speciation in Lake Malawi cichlids. And in a lot of other animals, it's been suggested that sexual selection should lead to speciation, Because, as I've said, it can lead to reproductive isolation. If you have different preferences arising amongst different groups of females, but the evidence for a lot of other groups of animals isn't as strong as it is for the Lake Malawi cichlids.
You mentioned that ungulate horns could also serve a thermoregulatory purpose. Is that also the case with the plates of Stegosaurus?
Absolutely. Stegosaurus plates are something that I look at and think, I really can't think of an explanation for those beyond sexual selection. But there's no reason why they shouldn't have a dual purpose and also act for thermoregulatory purposes.
Are there any clear, unambiguous examples of sexual selection in the fossil record?
As I'm sure we're going to discuss in just a minute, it's very hard to clearly demonstrate sexual selection in the fossil record. One situation where we can be reasonably confident about it comes when we look at animals that have gone extinct recently that have structures that are very clear analogues or homologues for similar structures on extant animals. So if we look at the extinct giant deer with its very, very large antlers that I'm sure you're all familiar with, those antlers are clear homologues of the antlers carried by other extant deer, and there's no reason to think that they used those antlers in any other way that would be different from the way that modern deer use their antlers. So when we're looking at recent extinctions, then we can be reasonably confident. When we go back a bit further, things get harder, and it becomes quite clear to unambiguously demonstrate sexual selection. Probably the best example we've got from animals that have been extinct for a long time comes from pterosaurs, and there's one species in particular called genus called Darwinopterus, and Darwinopterus has a crest on its head, and there are some fossils with crests and some fossils without crests. So people have looked at those and said, well, the ones with crests are probably males and the ones without crests are probably females. The ones without crests have a slightly wider pelvis than the ones with crests. So once again, we seem to be looking at an example where we've got males with a crest, females without. And then just recently, a fossil of Darwinopterus was found that actually had an egg in its pelvis. It seemed to have died while it was laying an egg. And so that clearly demonstrates that the ones without the crests are females. So the conclusion that the ones with the crests were males and that the crests were sexually selected seems pretty well supported. And that's about the best example we've got from something that's been extinct for a good few million years.
So how do you go about differentiating sexual variation in the fossil record?
It's actually extremely difficult. So one of the clearest indicators of sexual selection in extant animals is sexual dimorphism, which is where the two sexes look different. Quite often, if you're thinking about mammals, you'll find that males are bigger than females. If you're looking at insects, you'll find that females are bigger than males. And those are all for reasons to do with sexual selection. But also, we get sexual dimorphism in these actual sexually selected traits. So female peacocks do have rather longer tails than ordinary birds, but male peacocks have got much, much bigger trains than a female peacock. If we look at red deer, it's only the males that carry the antlers. If we look at beetle horns, my favourite things, then it's usually only the male beetles that have the horns and use them for fighting. So when we look at extant animals, if we see sexual dimorphism and we see a trait that's only carried on a single sex, then we're going to be pretty sure that's going to be sexually selected. It isn't necessarily sexually selected, but 99% of the time it's going to be sexually selected. Now, when you're looking at fossils, it's actually very difficult to demonstrate sexual dimorphism. If you've got subtle sexual dimorphism, say a dimorphism in size or a dimorphism where one trait is just a bit bigger than another, then you need a big sample size to actually demonstrate that. And by a big sample size, you might be thinking about 50 or 60 good specimens that you can measure to actually demonstrate sexual dimorphism. And obviously that's not available for a lot of fossil species. So when the sexual dimorphism is subtle, it's going to be hard to detect because you need a big sample size. And when the sexual dimorphism is a big sexual dimorphism, then what you might find is that your two sexes have been described as different species. And there's a really good example of this which is from the moa in New Zealand, Deinornis, the moa, the giant bird that lived in New Zealand until quite recently, when it was probably driven to extinction by human hunting. And I think it was Richard Owen originally described the moa as being three different species on North Island and South Island of New Zealand. So one small species and two big, well, by small, I mean only about the size of a human, and two big species that were your full-sized giant moa. And a couple of years ago, someone extracted a load of DNA from these fossils of the moa, which we can do because they're nice recent fossils, and found that, in fact, those three species are actually one species, and the two big species that Richard Owen identified are actually just the females of one species, and the little species are just the males. So even for a fossil where we've got really good recent fossils, we had males and females described as being different species. And that's going to be a big problem throughout the fossil record, is actually finding out when males and females are actually males and females and differentiating those from separate species. So when you've got subtle sexual dimorphism, you can't detect it because it's too subtle. And when you've got lots of sexual dimorphism, you can't detect it because your sexual dimorphs have been described as different species. So just looking for sexual dimorphism in the fossil record isn't particularly helpful. And what we have to do is look for other characteristics of sexually selected traits that are typical of sexually selected traits. And some of these are changes in growth during ontogeny. So if you see a trait which is either very small or absent in juvenile animals, but which then grows big in adult animals, that's pretty good evidence for sexual selection. We've been unable to find an example of a non-sexually selected trait that grows in exactly that way. Another thing that's typical of sexually selected traits is that they are very highly variable within species. So if you have examples of fossils with the trait that's very small, and then examples with it being very big, and there's a very large variance in the size of the trait, that's probably quite a good indicator that it may have been sexually selected, because as we discussed earlier, these things are condition dependent and are actually more sensitive to environmental variation than other aspects of an animal's morphology quite often. Another thing that can be indicative of sexual selection, and which is related to the amount of variance in the trait, is the allometric slope. If you plot the size of the trait against body size and then log both of them, then for some sexually selected traits, you get very steep slopes indeed that are steeper than we get for other traits. So if you find you've got an allometric slope of 2 or 2.5, as is the case with some hadrosaur crests, then that's pretty strong evidence that they were sexually selected, because we don't really have examples of other things that are that strongly positively allometric. Unfortunately, there are also plenty of sexually selected traits that aren't positively allometric, and there are some non-sexually selected traits that show slight positive allometry. So you've got to be pretty careful with that. But those are all things you can look for that will then help you decide whether a trait in a fossil species was sexually selected or not. But none of them are really definitive by themselves, and there's no absolute definitive test that we've got at the moment for a trait in a fossil organism that we can use to say this was definitely sexually selected. You have to be careful.
So we've mentioned pterosaurs and stegosaurus, but are there any other examples of fossil organisms with no modern analogues that have putative sexual selection or evidence of sexual selection?
Absolutely. Lots and lots of some of the most famous kinds of fossils around are actually famous because of traits that might well be sexually selected. And lots of these don't have modern analogues. So we've already talked about the trilobite Wallacerops with its trident growing out of its nose that may have been sexually selected. Another really important example of something which has no modern analogue that I can think of is the frills you get on ceratopsian dinosaurs. So obviously these guys had, or some of them had horns, but they all had the big frill growing out of their skull. And there's nothing really nowadays that's similar to that. And I think it's a fairly good bet that those were sexually selected. Crests on things like lambeosaurs and on some theropods as well don't really have obvious modern analogues apart from things like the crest on the cassowary. But a lot of lambeosaur crests obviously looked very, very different to cassowary crests. If you look at the amphibians, then probably the most famous fossil amphibian is Diplocaulus, the American fossil with the huge rostral horns growing out the side of its head. There's nothing like that nowadays, and those were probably sexually selected. I can make a good argument for those being sexually selected. And then there are some really weird things, like the shark Stethocanthus, which had got the front of its dorsal fin modified into a kind of strange flat anvil-shaped thing growing out of the back of its head, which was covered in small spikes. And we think that this modified fin on Stethocanthus was sexually selected. And again, there is absolutely nothing like that around nowadays. So there's lots and lots of examples and lots of very weird things in the fossil record that may well have been sexually selected.
One thing that we haven't covered so far with sexual selection is that it's not always just physical characteristics. There's a lot of mating rituals that happen as well. Are there any kind of trace fossil evidence for these? Can we see dances preserved in rocks, the footprints of them?
I'm not aware of any trace fossils that can be interpreted as being evidence of mating behaviour or mating display. We do have one example that I know of a fossil of an actual animal that's been interpreted as showing mating behaviour. There's a small Carboniferous shark that you find in Montana, I think, called Falcatus. And Falcatus appears to be sexually dimorphic. There are animals with, again, the front of the dorsal fin modified into a kind of scythe blade shaped structure projecting over the top of their head. And then there are otherwise identical fossils in the same rocks that don't have that structure. And there's actually a fossil been found of two Falcatus, one with this and one without it. And the one without it is holding the structure growing out of the other one's head in its mouth in this fossil. And that's been interpreted as being some kind of behavior that these animals might actually have used while they were engaged in some kind of mating display, or while the female was assessing the size of the structure on the male or something like that.
So overall, how important do you think sexual selection has been in driving evolution?
I think sexual selection is extremely important, not only in terms of the very obvious display traits that we see in animals today and also probably in many, many extinct animals, but there's increasing evidence that sexual selection is important in determining other macroevolutionary patterns as well. So we've talked about speciation as being something that can be driven by sexual selection. There's also good evidence that sexual selection should increase adaptation rates. So if you have a sexually selected species where the females are choosing the males on the basis of the quality of the males and the environment changes, then what makes up a good quality male will change as the environment changes. And if the females are choosing straight away those males that are better adapted to the new environment, then the entire species should adapt faster to the new environment than it would do were it not sexually selected. So sexual selection, it seems, is likely to be able to drive adaptation rates. It's likely to be able to drive speciation. And it may also be important in determining extinction rates. So you can argue the extinction rates went both ways. Some people have argued that strongly sexually selected species should be more at risk of extinction because they're paying this heavy price for carrying their sexually selected trait. Alternatively, you can argue that sexually selected species should be less at risk of extinction because they have faster adaptation rates and are better able to adapt to a changing climate, and also because sexual selection should allow a reduction in the effect of inbreeding in small populations, which is one of the things that sends small populations to extinction. So you can argue the extinction one either way, and at the moment we don't really have the data to provide a definitive answer to that. But overall, you can see that sexual selection, in addition to creating these amazing, fabulous and extraordinary traits and behaviours that we see in modern animals, and also probably lots and lots of the most interesting diversity that we see in extinct animals, sexual selection can also be a very important driver of macroevolutionary trends, and it can probably determine things like adaptation rates and extinction rates.
How about within our own evolutionary lineage?
Well, human beings are sexually selected just as much as many other animals are. We know that the extent of sexual dimorphism in between males and females usually reflects how strongly sexually selected they are. Humans are moderately sexually dimorphic, so it seems that there's been a reasonable degree of sexual selection going on in our recent evolutionary past. As I said, when we were talking about sperm competition, the average size of testes in human males indicates, in much the same way as sexual dimorphism does, that human males are moderately sexually selected, although not very strongly sexually selected. And when we look at fossil humans, so hominid fossils, there have been a number of arguments that fossils that have been described as two separate species, a robust species and a gracile species, for example, might actually be sexual dimorphs of a single species. So there's good reason to think that sexual selection is operating on humans now, and there's good reason to think that it's been operating on our recent ancestors too.
All right, thank you very much, Rob.
Okay, cheers, guys. Have a good one.
I found that absolutely amazing. I hadn't really thought about sexual selection before. And actually, some of the stuff that I'm working on, I think this could these techniques that we've been talking about, looking at ontogeny, for instance, in allometry, I could really use these. So it's been eye-opening for me, at least.
Yeah, it's been really good. It's so nice having things from a biological perspective looking back into the fossil record rather than the other way around. So it's given us quite a lot of information, and a lot of it made a lot of sense. So I think now would be a good time to introduce our new project, Paleo 101.
Oh, yeah.
So obviously Joe's up to date on it and can explain it clearly and concisely.
So Paleo 101 is a project that me and Dave initially talked about sometime last year, but we're actually getting the ball rolling now. What we want to produce is a series of resources that can be used by school teachers and at college level that follow the syllabus outlined in the UK and also in other countries, definitely America and Australia, our biggest listening populations. And yeah, we're currently looking for contributions. So if you are a paleontologist and want to contribute to our Paleo 101 series, please get in touch with us, info@paleocast.com.
Yeah, please do. So this all really kicked off when in the UK, the Earth Science Teachers Association put out a request in the Paleontological Association's newsletter asking for digital resources for the teaching of paleontology. So a lot of teachers are really limited as to what they can show the kids. So they can't get hold of all the important fossils, for example. It's pretty hard to get replicas of them, and also good royalty-free images, because so many academics are protective over their property. So what we're hoping to do is crowdsource a lot of materials for teachers to use and then make them freely available to download. And so we're hoping to get lots of images, lots of diagrams and videos. So please, if you've got something to contribute, we'd love to hear from you.
Demand is there. And like everything on Paleocast, it's worth mentioning, this will be absolutely free to download. Everything will be free.
Yep. Oh, we've also got, should we mention our new people? Do we mention that?
Oh, yes, we should mention our new people.
Yeah, so as part of that, to help us out, we've actually got some new recruits, some new volunteers. So hopefully a lot of you will remember Dr. Layla Batterson from our very, very first episode on the earliest fossils and the hunt for extraterrestrial life. So she's actually going to be helping us out with that. We've also got Laura Soule from the University of Oxford, and also Abby Othman-Wilson, who's from the University of Aberdeen, and I think is going to be in Hawaii very soon. So we've got plenty of support on this, so big shout out to those guys.
So yeah, Paleocast is growing, and we're moving into new areas, specifically education outreach. So we're really glad that we keep building our audience base, and hope you keep on listening.
Yeah, it's been great having you, and it's been great doing all of these interviews. I'm having a really good time, and I hope you are too.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
Actually, I should start recording this in case I say something good. So it's time to do a sexual selection episode. We've touched on it a couple of times when we were talking to Dave Hone about archosaurs during the Mesozoic, and also when we were talking to Russell Garwood about penis size and things like that.
Hey, do you know that Russell's episode got 214 downloads on the first day? Well, it was first half day.
Really? That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that breaks our record. So our original record, first day of downloads, was 186, and that was with two episodes. And then the Palace episode got 185, so we were one download short of our all-time record. And then Russell's one, 214 in just half a day, and he's got 173 downloads. In today and yesterday. So that's really,
I don't know if you
bad.
Know this audience, but me and Dave, we're pretty big news now.
Yeah, you're in an exclusive listening club. We only let the coolest people in.